Many believe that the changing definitions of courage mirrors a cultural shift that has diminished the value of women's voices and stories. In the late 1990s, 150 therapists gathered in Vermont to talk about courage and the world's evolution. Elizabeth Bernstein, a therapist and one of the conference organizers, explained that courage is not just about slaying the dragon, but about being true to yourself and speaking your mind. Reverend Jane Spar, a Presbyterian minister and gay lesbian rights activist, also attended the conference. Reverend Spar told the stories of St. George and St. Martha to illustrate the different ways we think about courage. She explained that St. George slew the dragon because the dragon was bad, but St. Martha tamed and befriended the dragon. She went on to say, "This is one of our feminist myths that has been lost. Courage could mean to slay the dragon, but could it also mean to tame our fears?" When I heard Susan, Kayla, Teresa, Sandra, Jillian, and the rest of the women I interviewed tell their stories, I was struck by their openness. But as I listened, I realized it was more than openness. It was courage. Every woman who participated in this research willingly embraced her fears in order for us to learn. When we tell our stories, we change the world. I know that sounds dramatic, but I believe it. We'll never know how our stories might change someone's life. Our children's, our friends, our parents, our partners, or maybe that of a stranger who hears the story down the line or reads it in a book. But courage, especially the ordinary courage we need to speak out, is not simple or easily obtained. So often we hear people say, "Just tell your story," or "Speak your mind." It's much more complicated than that. Sometimes we face real threats and consequences when we speak our minds or tell our stories. In fact, as you start to learn about the four elements of shame resilience, you'll see that most of us will have to do a lot of work before we can get to the element of reaching out and sharing our stories. Sometimes compassion is listening to someone's story, and other times it's sitting with her in her fear about not being ready to share. In her article on ordinary courage in girls and women's lives, Annie Rogers writes, "One way to understand the etymology of courage is to consider its history as a series of losses. Over the course of five centuries, from 1051 to 1490, courage was cut off from its sources in time, in the heart, and in feelings. In other words, courage was slowly dissociated from what traditional Western culture considers feminine qualities, and came to mean that quality of mind that shows itself in facing danger without fear or shrinking, a definition associated with bravery and heroism of boys and men. The pattern of losses in the history of the word courage seems to reflect an increasing invisibility of girls' and women's courage in Western culture. Without courage, we cannot tell our stories. When we don't tell our stories, we miss the opportunity to experience empathy and move toward shame resilience. Empathy and compassion. If empathy is the skill or ability to tap into our own experiences in order to connect with an experience someone is relating to us, compassion is the willingness to be open to this process. To prepare for writing this book, I read everything I could find on compassion. I ultimately found a powerful fit between the stories I heard in the interviews and the work of American Buddhist nun Pema Chodron. In her book, The Places That Scare You, Chodron writes, "When we practice generating compassion, we can expect to experience the fear of our pain. Compassion practice is daring. It involves learning to relax and allow ourselves to move gently toward what scares us. The trick to doing this is to stay with emotional distress without tightening into aversion, to let fear soften us rather than harden into resistance." When we hear and watch someone tell us the story behind her shame, can we lean into the discomfort of her pain? When Allison, the young woman whose mother committed suicide, tells us about her mother's death and what that's meant for her, can we sit with her in that pain? When the woman whose son is struggling in addiction tells us about her pain, can we be with her in her shame? Or do we feel the need to make it better or redirect the conversation? If we are willing to be open and present, we are willing to practice compassion. I write practice because I believe compassion is a commitment and takes constant practice. Sheldren teaches that we must be honest and forgiving about when and how we shut down. Without justifying or condemning ourselves, we do the courageous work of opening to suffering. This can be the pain that comes when we put up barriers, or the pain of opening our heart to our own sorrow, or that of another being. We learn as much about doing this from our failures as we do from our successes. In cultivating compassion, we draw from the wholeness of our experience, our suffering, our empathy, as well as our cruelty and terror. It has to be this way. Compassion is not a relationship between the healer and the wounded. It's a relationship between equals. Only when we know our own darkness well can we be present with the darkness of others. Compassion becomes real when we recognize our shared humanity. Better late than never. I'm frequently asked if I think that it's ever too late to express empathy. Can we go back when we miss the opportunity to be empathic? Interestingly, many women spoke about this during the interviews, and the resounding answer was, better late than never. The impact of late empathy might be different from what we'd experience if someone responded empathically right away, but the potential for strengthening the relationship is still there. Let me give you a personal example. Recently, I was eating dinner with a friend. We both had newborns at the time. She stayed at home with her baby and her toddler, and I was getting ready to go back to work. She was telling me about the terrible sadness she felt about the fact that she and her husband were probably not going to have any more children. She explained that even though having two young children was overwhelming at times, she had always wanted three or four, and that she was really having a difficult time letting go of that vision of a family. As she was talking, I was listening. However, the voices in my head were drowning her out. Oh my God, what was she thinking? Two is awesome. I'm so happy. This is perfect for me. My response to her was something like, two is perfect. It gets a lot more demanding when they get in elementary school. Plus, you could go back to work or graduate school or something. She looked kind of shocked by my reply and stumbled to find the right words. Well, I'm enjoying staying home with them right now. And if I had another child, it wouldn't stop me from going back to school or work, if I even want to do that. I'm not afraid of working or going back to school with three or four kids. I scoffed. Well, you should be afraid. She very quickly changed the subject, and after doing the uncomfortable surface chat for the next 10 minutes, we both got in our cars and headed home. I felt horrible. 2 minutes after we drove out of the parking lot, I called her on her cell phone. Where are you? She sounded surprised. I'm at the corner. Why? Are you okay? I told her I needed to talk to her and asked her if she could pull into the gas station across the street. I pulled in behind her and walked up to her car. She got out and asked, what's wrong? I explained, I need to apologize for what I said and what I didn't say. When you told me that you were having a hard time about possibly not having more kids, I wasn't there for you. I'm really sorry. I want to understand and be here for you. I can tell you're really sad. Will you give me another chance? I'm lucky. She was courageous. She started crying and said, yeah, what you said felt bad, and I am really sad. This is incredibly hard for me. I started crying. We talked about it for a while, then we hugged. She thanked me for pulling over, and I thanked her for accepting my apology and, as important, giving me another chance. It takes a lot of courage to share your hurt with someone. It takes even more courage to do it twice, especially after they shut you down the first time. After reflecting on this situation, I finally figured out that when she started talking to me about not having more children, I instantly heard grief in her voice, and that scared me. In fact, it shut down my compassion. I could have handled anger or fear, or maybe even shame, but not grief. I was experiencing high levels of stress and anxiety about my book deadline. I was also in my own grief about the next time that I would be away from my new baby as I headed back to work. I filtered her story through my emotions. In other words, my own stuff just got in the way of my compassion. There are times we will miss the opportunity to be empathic. Mental health professionals often call these empathic failures. There are also times when the people around us will not be able to give us what we need. When this happens on occasion, most of our relationships can survive, and even thrive, if we work to repair the empathic failures. However, most relationships can't withstand repeated failed attempts at empathy. This is especially true if we find ourselves constantly rationalizing and justifying why we can't be empathic with someone, or why someone is not offering us the empathy we need. I could have easily told myself, "You know what? She needed to hear that. She's crazy for thinking about another baby so soon. I'm sorry if it hurt her feelings, but someone has to tell it like it is." And my friend could have responded to my request for her to let me in again by saying, "No, it's not a big deal. I'm fine." Developing our empathy skills is not easy. Shame is a complex problem that requires a complex solution. Each of the four attributes of empathy requires us to know ourselves, act authentically, and engage with others using our minds and our hearts. This act of empathy produces resilience to shame by countering fear and disconnection. Empathy and connection. For women, connection is about mutual support, shared experiences, acceptance, and belonging. Individuals and groups that may enforce the expectations that create shame in one area can turn out to be a valued source of connection building in another area. In relationships, we are given threads. We can use these threads to weave webs that trap others or to weave blankets of support. It's our choice. For example, a colleague might be a tremendous source of connection around shame experiences that develop from personal situations, yet he or she might make comments or reinforce stereotypes that trigger shame in others, like motherhood or sexual orientation. Researchers and activists Lorraine Gutierrez and Edith Ann Lewis's concept of connection captures its ability to counter the messages, expectations, and stereotypes that form the shame web. They write, "Connection serves two purposes: the development of social support networks and the creation of power through interaction. Involvement with others in similar situations provides individuals with the means for acquiring and providing mutual aid, with the opportunity to learn new skills through role modeling, with strategies for dealing with likely institutional reprisals, and with a potential power base for future action." When we develop and practice empathy, courage, and compassion, we move from disconnection to connection. This creates the liberation we need to enjoy the things we value rather than be imprisoned by what others expect. When we are ready to start practicing empathy, we should start with our most important relationship, the one we have with ourself. I write about self-empathy in Chapter 9, but I want to address it here as well. It is important to understand that we cannot practice empathy with others unless we can be empathic with ourselves. If, for example, we judge ourselves harshly and are incapable or unwilling to acknowledge our emotions, we will struggle in our relationships with others. If we make a mistake, and our self-talk is, "I'm so stupid, I can't do anything right," then we are more likely to turn to our child or partner who has made a mistake and convey the same feelings, even if we don't say them out loud. Empathy and connection require us to know and accept ourselves before we can know and accept others. Barriers to empathy. Sympathy versus empathy. When we talk about empathy, we often confuse it with sympathy, Yet during the interviews, women were very clear about the differences between sympathy and empathy. When they talked about their ability to overcome shame, they clearly pointed to empathy, sharing their feelings with someone who would understand and relate to what they were saying. Conversely, women used words like hate, despise, and can't stand to describe their feelings about sympathy seeking, looking for sympathy, or being asked for sympathy. Empathy seeking is driven by the need to know that we are not alone. We need to know that other people have experienced similar feelings, and that our experiences don't keep us from being accepted and affirmed. Empathy helps us move away from shame toward resilience. Sympathy, on the other hand, can actually exacerbate shame. To illustrate the difference between sympathy and empathy, let's go back to the cookie story. About a week after my conversation with Dawn, Steve and I were eating dinner with some friends who really appear to be the super working parents. During dinner, they told a story about parents who had the gall to bring sugary store-bought treats in plastic bags to their 7-year-old son's homeroom party. Of course, I'm one notch below store-bought treats. I'm the treat thief. I reacted to their story by saying, "Well, when I remember to bring treats, they're normally store-bought. It's a rare occasion that I have the time to make something homemade." They gave me this quasi-friendly upside-down smile, like they were thinking, let's make a note of this. So for some reason, this response compelled me to tell the cookie appropriation story. Maybe I was trying to test the waters. Given their comments about store-bought snacks, could we possibly belong to their club? Dawn had showed empathy, but she wasn't a mother at the time. Maybe I was seeking redemption from these super parents. If they could understand, I must be okay. It was one of those stories you begin telling with enthusiasm and a strong commitment to be genuine. But in the middle, when you sense it's not going over very well, you skip the worst details and try to wrap it up as quickly as possible. I don't know what I was expecting, but I certainly didn't expect them to literally gasp and put their hands over their eyes, like looking at me might blind them. When I was done, they shook their heads in unison and looked at me with pity. She leaned toward me and said, "Oh my God, that's so horrible. I can't imagine doing that. I'm so sorry." Their sympathy slapped me across the face. Like all sympathy, it said, "I'm over here, and you're over there. I'm sorry for you, and I'm sad for you. And while I'm sorry that happened to you, let's be clear. I'm over here." This is not compassion. In most cases, when we give sympathy, we do not reach across to understand the world as others see it. We look at others from our world and feel sorry or sad for them. Inherent in sympathy is, "I don't understand your world. But from this view, things look pretty bad." Looking back, I think the worst thing that she said to me was probably, "I can't imagine doing that." When she said that, it was very clear that she didn't see the world as I saw it. She saw my experience from her world, and again, that's not empathy. Secondly, I certainly felt judged. I heard nothing that told me she understood my feelings, and in no way did she communicate her understanding of my experience. When our need for empathy is met with sympathy, it can often send us deeper into shame. We feel even more alone and separated. Empathy is about connection. Sympathy is about separation. Sympathy seeking. On the flip side of responding to empathy seeking with sympathy is the complex issue of trying to express empathy when someone is seeking sympathy. One sentiment underlying sympathy seeking is often, "Feel sorry for me because I'm the only one this is happening to," or, "My situation is worse than everyone else's." This naturally creates disconnection and separation. People seeking sympathy are not looking for empathy or evidence of shared experiences. They are searching for confirmation of their uniqueness. When I talk about sympathy seeking in workshops, the audience members usually start to look agitated and crusty. I learned early on how to diffuse the situation. I just have to ask, how many of you know someone who sympathy seeks and are thinking of that person as I describe this concept? Without fail, hands shoot up across the room. The participants are anxious to talk about the person they're envisioning and how irritating he or she is. I've had many people tell me that they feel manipulated and controlled by the people in their lives who are sympathy-seeking. I even hear those descriptors from therapists who often feel stuck when they're working with someone who is in sympathy-seeking mode. It's not unusual to feel resentful or dismissive when someone requests our sympathy. When people look for sympathy, it feels like a no-win situation. On the one hand, they are telling us that they have it worse than anyone and no one can understand. But on the other hand, they are looking for our validation. I interviewed one woman who said, "In my family, my husband is the only one who is entitled to have it hard. Even if I'm going through something just like him or something worse, the attention needs to be on him. He's not asking for help. He just wants me to tell him that his life is hard and unfair and worse than mine. He thinks he works harder, sleeps less, and does more. Trust me, he doesn't." Sometimes the best we can do with someone who is sympathy-seeking is to fake a, "Yeah, that's really hard," or, "Wow, sounds rough." But on the inside, we're probably thinking, "Please, get over it," or, "Hey, that's nothing," or, "Enough of the pity party." Sometimes these requests for sympathy make us so angry and resentful that we can't even muster a benign response. However they play out, it's easy to see why these exchanges rarely produce real connection and understanding. While sympathy seeking is often about casting ourselves in a unique light, we can certainly communicate feeling alone and feeling like the only one without sympathy seeking. What separates sympathy and empathy is our motivation for sharing struggles. And ironically, our motivation for sympathy seeking is often shame. My first year as a doctoral student, I did a lot of sympathy seeking. Unsurprisingly, the more I sought sympathy, the more alone I felt. I was so overwhelmed by my classes that the shame and fear of potential failure was too real and imminent for me to say, "I'm drowning. I feel like I'm in over my head, and if I quit or fail, my life is going to be over." While that sentiment is relatable for almost everyone I know, I just wasn't in a place where I could clearly understand, much less articulate, my true feelings. I would say, "You have no idea what the pressure is like. It's not like getting an undergraduate degree, or the office." For the people around me, this translated to, "This is more important than anything you've ever done, so feel really sorry for me." When friends and family responded to my plea with half-hearted sympathy, I would dig myself in even more by thinking, "I knew it. It's not like any of them is in a doctoral program." When we find ourselves seeking sympathy, it is helpful to step back and think about what we are really feeling, what it is we're seeking, and what we really need. On the other hand, when we are asked to give sympathy, we have to decide if we want to simply give it and move on, or really try to connect and develop empathy. If we want to develop connection and understanding, sometimes the best way to practice compassion is to say, "It sounds like you are in a hard place. Tell me more about it." Or, "You're right. I don't know what that's like. What is it like? Help me understand." Sometimes when I facilitate groups, I'll even say to someone, "You are telling us that no one can understand, yet you're asking us to understand. What should we do? We want to connect, but you're telling us it's impossible." Often, a dialogue grounded in these questions can lead to genuine empathy and connection. Stacking the deck. Another barrier to developing empathy is a phenomenon I call stacking the deck. In many ways, this is related to sympathy-seeking behavior. Over and over, women described how devastated they were after they finally mustered up the courage to reach out to someone, but then had their story trumped by the "you think you've got it bad" card. "I'll see your drunk mother and raise you a drug addict sister." "I'll see you're unmarried and 30 and raise you a single mom." When we compete to see whose situation is worse, whose oppression is the most real, or whose ism is the most serious, we lose sight of the fact that most of our struggles stem from the same place, powerlessness and disconnection. If we spend our resources attempting to outdo one another, competing for last place or stepping on each other to climb out of shame. Shame will always prevail. It will prevail because being told, "That's nothing," can make us feel like nothing. Most of us will feed shame with our silence before we risk sharing something that we fear might not be as bad as someone else's situation, or bad enough to warrant empathy. Lorraine, a woman in her early 20s, talked about the shame she felt when she finally opened up with her college roommate, about the fact that her teenaged brother was schizophrenic and had a history of violence before he was stabilized on his medications. She had asked me about him several times. I finally told her about him, and I started crying. I explained that I'm not ashamed of him, but I'm ashamed that my parents have him living in a treatment center. She didn't say anything back to me. When I asked her what happened next in the conversation, Lorraine said, "My roommate just stood up and said, 'That's no big deal. Kendall's, their sweet mate, little sister was killed in a car wreck. That's got to be way worse.' Then she walked into the bathroom. I felt so small, I wish I hadn't said anything at all." We don't know why Lorraine's roommate was unable or unwilling to respond empathically. Perhaps she was fearful about the level of emotion she saw in Lorraine, or maybe she just didn't want to know. There are many reasons. Let's look at a couple of other common responses as examples of how easy it is to skip right over empathy. "I feel like my marriage is falling apart, right before my very eyes." Response A. "Oh no, you and Tim are a great couple. I'm sure everything will be fine." This is the "you have not been heard" and "they're not going there" response. Response B. "At least you have a marriage. John and I haven't had a real marriage for years." I call this the "I'm bringing it back to me" response. It lacks concern and empathy completely. There aren't many hard and fast rules about empathy, but this might be one. "At least" is not a good lead-in for an empathic response. "I had a miscarriage." "At least you know you can get pregnant." "I've been diagnosed with cancer." "At least you caught it early." "My sister is really struggling with her alcoholism." "At least it's not drugs." This "at least" response is primarily about our own discomfort. At leasting someone is equivalent to shutting her down. Response C. "I'm really sorry. That can be a very lonely place. Is there anything I can do?" This response demonstrates empathy. It is not judgmental. It's an attempt to reflect back how someone might be feeling. Even if she's not feeling lonely, she has a chance to respond, and she knows you are trying to understand her world. The pressure to get it right, or to say the perfect thing, can be the biggest barrier to empathy and compassion. We start to experience anxiety about saying the right thing, and before we know it, we've missed the opportunity to be empathic and compassionate. We diminish, change the subject, or walk away. Lorraine's roommate didn't have to say anything magical. She could have just said, "Gosh, that must be so hard for everyone in your family." Or, "That would be hard for me too. How is your brother doing in the center?" Often just hearing about someone's shaming experience can cause us to want to shield ourselves. We don't want to hear it. It's too painful just to listen. One reason empathy and compassion are so powerful is the fact that they say to someone, "I can hear this. This is hard, but I can be in this space with you." Digging deep. Another way we avoid empathic connection is by convincing ourselves that we can't really understand experiences that we haven't actually had. Lorraine's roommate might have thought, "I have no idea what it's like to have a brother with a mental illness. How am I supposed to know what to say?" The bottom line is this. If we want to build connection networks, networks that really help us move from shame to empathy, we cannot reserve empathy for the select few who have had experiences that mirror our own. We must learn how to move past the situations and events that people are describing in order to move toward the feelings and the emotions they're experiencing. For example, one of the participants spoke about the difficulty of being an African-American medical student. Here's how she described her experience. For me, shame is about being too black at school and too white for my family and friends at home. In medical school, everyone looks at me like I don't belong. I feel like they wonder if I'm the affirmative action case. It's not just about race, either. I'm also from a pretty poor family. I went to college on scholarships. Most of my friends didn't even finish high school. When I'm at school, it's clear that I'm different. When I go home, they give me a hard time. One time my grandmother said, "Leave that white coat and that white attitude at the door. Don't be thinking you're Marcus Welby around here." Even though I act the same, they assume I think I'm better than they are. I don't. I just want to feel like I fit someplace. Now, I would venture to say the majority of us are not black medical students. Most of us have not had the experience of straddling the very white male world of medicine and black family life. If we read her quote and we walk away thinking, "Wow, that sounds pretty tough, but I can't really relate to that," then we've missed an opportunity for empathy. This is critical because our level of shame resilience depends equally on both our ability to receive empathy and our ability to extend empathy. On missing the opportunity to be empathic, Jean Baker Miller and Irene Stiver, researchers and therapists from the Stone Center, write, "The phenomenon of empathy is basic to all our relationships. Either we deal with the feelings that are inevitably present in our interactions by turning to each other, or we turn away. If we turn away from others without conveying recognition of the existence of their feelings, we inevitably leave the other person diminished in some degree. We are also inevitably turning away from engaging fully with our own experience, dealing with it in a less than optimal way. That is, in isolation. If we reach far enough into our own experiences, most of us can relate to trying to keep one foot in one world and the other foot in another world. Most of us know what that feels like. When I open myself up to hearing beyond the struggles of balancing medical school and family life, I immediately think about trying to keep one foot in motherhood and one foot in a very male-defined academic world. When I'm in one world, the message is, it's great that you're a mother, but we don't really want to see any evidence of that around here. If your children are sick, you'll still need to be here. If their daycare closes, we would prefer you not bring them here. So I have one foot in this world where I'm allowed to be a mother, but only if it doesn't detract from my focus as an academic. And my other foot is in motherhood, where it's okay that I work at pursuing something I think is important, but not if it disrupts anything that goes on at home. On some days I can stay balanced. On other days I feel fearful that the worlds will drift so far apart that I'll end up losing my footing in both. The worst feeling for me is that sense that I'm the only person about to be split in half. I'm not an African-American medical school student, but I've had similar experiences in terms of trying to balance two worlds that often seem mutually exclusive. For me, this experience makes me feel lonely, unworthy, and like something is wrong with me. So when I read her statement about shame, while I certainly do not want to project my experiences onto her, I do want to be able to touch, in myself, some of the emotions that she might be feeling so that I can try to connect with what she's saying. I don't have to tell her my story. I certainly wouldn't say, "I know exactly what you mean," because I don't. I may know what it feels like to try to balance different roles, but I don't know what racism feels like. I don't know how exhausting it is to have to constantly shift from one culture to another in order to fit in. I don't believe we can fully understand racism, sexism, homophobia, ageism, or any other form of oppression unless we've experienced it. However, I do believe that we're all responsible for constantly developing our understanding of oppression and recognizing our part in perpetuating it. Empathy is a powerful place to start. So often I find that our feelings of unearned privilege kill empathy. By unearned privilege, I mean the privileges afforded us simply because we are white or straight or members of certain groups. We get stuck in what I call privilege shame. This is very different from privilege guilt or white guilt. It's appropriate to feel guilt over forwarding a racist email or telling a hurtful joke. Guilt can motivate change. Guilt helps us reconcile our choices with our values. Shame doesn't help. If we feel ashamed because we don't know how to relate to someone who is different or connect with someone who faces unfair discrimination, we get stuck. If we think, "I'm a bad person because I can't relate to her," or "I'm a bad person because I have this and they don't," we get paralyzed. For me, I've come to a place in my life where unlearning prejudice is more important than avoiding situations where I might be accused of saying or doing the wrong thing. I've learned that it is better for me to accept the fact that I struggle with many of the same learned biases that other people do. This has allowed me to spend my energy unlearning and changing my prejudices rather than proving that I don't have any. When we are honest about our struggles, we are much less likely to get stuck in shame. This is critical because shame diminishes our capacity to practice empathy. Ultimately, feeling shame about privilege actually perpetuates racism, sexism, heterosexism, classism, ageism, etc. I don't have to know exactly how you feel. I just have to touch a part of my life that opens me up to hearing your experience. If I can touch that place, I stay out of judgment, and I can reach out with empathy. This is where both personal and social healing can begin. Imagine what it would be like if we could only reach out to folks who have had our exact experiences. We would all be very much alone. Life experiences are like fingerprints. No two are exactly alike. Furthermore, even if we've had what we believe is the exact same experience as someone else, we can never know exactly how they feel. Going back to the lens metaphor, there are just too many variables for any of us to experience anything the exact same way. Below are five more shame experiences from my research. Under each, I've labeled some of the emotions that I heard in the interviews, and I've posed empathy questions that might help us connect with that experience. Experience. When I think of shame, I think of being sexually abused when I was growing up. I think about what that's done to my life and how it's changed everything. It's not just the abuse itself, it's everything you have to deal with the rest of your life. It's like you feel different from anyone else. Nothing is ever normal for you. Everything is about that. I'm not allowed just to have a regular life. That is the thing that made me who I am, and so everything is stained by that. That's what shame is for me. Emotions. Feeling labeled, dismissed, misunderstood, and reduced. Emotions might include grief, loss, frustration, and anger. Dig deep. Have you ever been defined by an experience? Found yourself unable to get out from under a reputation or an incident? Have you ever been unfairly labeled? Have you ever had people attribute your behaviors to an identity you don't deserve? Have you ever fought to overcome something, only to find others less than willing to move past it? Experience. I'm ashamed because I always hate my life. No matter what I have, and no matter how much I have, I'm always disappointed with my life. I always think to myself, if only I had this or that, I'd be happy. I get this or that, and I'm still not happy. It's a horrible part of me, and I don't know how to make it go away. I can't talk about it with anyone because everyone is sick of hearing how disappointed I am about everything all the time. That's what's shameful to me. I just can never seem to pull it all together and find happiness. Emotions. Stuck, angry, overwhelmed, disappointed, confused, lost, alone. Dig deep. Do you ever feel like happiness is always in front of you? Do you ever set yourself up to be happy when you lose 20 pounds, or get a new house, or have another baby, or get promoted? Do you define success by what you don't have? Do you ever dismiss what you do have because it must not be that great if you have it? Do you ever feel like people are sick of hearing you complain or vent? Experience. Shame is when my husband left me for another woman, and my son told me it was because I was a fat ass. He's only 14, and I don't think he meant it. Or at least I hope not. He's just used to hearing it from his father. Plus he's angry, and maybe he does think it's my fault. Maybe I think it's my fault. Emotions. Hurt, loss, anger, fear, grief, self-blame, confused, isolated, trapped. Dig deep. Have you ever struggled not to blame yourself? Have you ever been the target of someone's anger and grief? Have you ever had to take care of someone when you could barely take care of yourself? Have you ever had a child parrot a partner's insults? Experience. When I made partner at the law firm, I went into a terrible depression. Everything I had worked for seemed like nothing. Every day I went to work thinking, oh my God, when are they going to catch on to the fact that I don't know what I'm doing? I didn't deserve a promotion. I don't deserve a partnership. They're going to find out that I'm really not good. The pressure was so much that I finally had to step down. I don't think people respect me anymore. I just couldn't do it. I don't know if I was really that good and I deserved it, or that I really was never that good, and I was faking it. It just got too confusing. Emotions. Fear, self-blame, confusion, overwhelmed, isolation, insecure, loss, disappointment. Dig deep. Have you ever felt like an imposter? Like people think you are more capable than you really are? Have you ever feared getting caught when you didn't do anything wrong? Have you ever felt the pressure of disappointing others? Yourself? It's easy to think that it is safer to distance ourselves rather than dig for empathy. But as social worker Marky McMillan writes, empathy is a gift of validation that no matter how many times it is given, always returns us to our own truth. Empathy heals another at exactly the same time it is healing me. Don't we need a little shame to keep us in line? Another barrier to being empathic centers around our beliefs about shame. If we believe that shame is a constructive emotion, we might not be interested in being empathic. We might listen to someone's experience and think, you should feel ashamed. When I started this research, I wasn't sure about the distinction I had seen drawn between good shame and bad shame. There is a small group of researchers, especially those working from an evolutionary or biological perspective, who believe that shame has both negative and positive consequences. The positive consequence of shame, they contend, is the ability to serve as a compass for moral behavior. They believe that shame keeps us in line. 7 years of testing the proposition that shame can't be used to change people, combined with a lack of actual data supporting this claim, made me a little suspicious, but I was willing to let the research speak for itself. It didn't take very long for me to reach the conclusion that there is nothing positive about shame, in any form, in any context, and through any delivery system. Shame is destructive. The idea that there are two types, healthy shame and toxic shame, did not bear out in any of my research. When I talk to women about the possibility of shame having positive outcomes or serving as a guidepost for good behavior, they made it clear that shame is so overbearing and painful that regardless of the intent, it moved them away from being able to grow, change, and respond in any kind of genuine or authentic way. Guilt, on the other hand, was often a strong motivator for change. Again, there are researchers who disagree with this proposition and continue to believe in a concept of healthy shame, but there is now a growing body of evidence against that idea. One of the most comprehensive books on shame research is Shame and Guilt by June Price Tangney and Rhonda L. Deering. In it, Tangney and Deering offer an excellent overview of the shame and guilt literature, and they present some of their own research on these emotions. In a section of their book entitled, Does Shame Serve Any Adaptive Function?, Tangney and Deering explain how earlier conceptualizations of shame may not take into consideration the current way people self-evaluate and relate to one another. They write, "With increasingly complex perspective-taking and attributional abilities, modern humans have the capacity to distinguish between self and behavior, to take another person's perspective, and to empathize with others' distress. Whereas early moral goals centered on reducing potentially lethal aggression, clarifying social rank, and enhancing conformity to social norms, modern morality centers on the ability to acknowledge one's wrongdoing, accept responsibility, and take reparative action. In this sense, guilt may be the moral emotion of the new millennium." If you're interested in additional reading about shame, the distinctions between shame and guilt, and how shame is measured in research, this is an excellent book, though it may feel a little research-heavy for some. To help clarify the difference between shame and guilt when it comes to positive behavioral outcomes, I'd like to tell you about two important studies described in their book. The first is Tangney and Deering's 8-year study of moral emotions, in which they followed a group of almost 400 children. Using a measurement instrument that presented potentially shaming or guilt-eliciting situations, they found that shame proneness in fifth graders, that is, a susceptibility to shame, was a strong predictor of later school suspension, drug use, including amphetamines, depressants, hallucinogens, and heroin, and suicide attempts. On the other hand, when they compared children who were guilt-prone, the guilt-prone fifth graders were more likely to later apply to college and to be involved in community service. They were less likely to make suicide attempts, use heroin, or drive under the influence of alcohol or drugs, and they began having sex at a later age. The second is a substance abuse study conducted by Deering, Stewig, and Tangney. The researchers found that when shame proneness increases, substance abuse problems increase. In the same study, they found that guilt proneness may have a protective effect against the development of problematic alcohol and drug use patterns. I've written more about this study in Chapter 9. As we learn more about the positive aspects of guilt, I believe it is important to remember that feeling guilty is only adaptive if we are the ones who are actually responsible for a specific outcome, event, or behavior. Too often in our society, women are blamed when they bear no responsibility and socialized to take responsibility for things they shouldn't. In her book, Changing Course, Healing from Loss, Abandonment, and Fear, Dr. Claudia Black refers to this type of guilt as false guilt. She writes, "Feeling guilty for other people's behaviors and actions is a false guilt. Taking on guilt for things over which we had no control is false guilt. There are enough things in life for which we are responsible and therefore can experience true guilt." This is also not a call to raise guilt-prone kids. More than anything, these findings are additional evidence that seriously call into question shame's ability to produce good behavior. I think all of us are capable of remembering a time when we were experiencing profound shame. I can honestly say in those moments of shame, when I felt rejected, worthless, and degraded, I was far more likely to engage in inappropriate behaviors than I was to choose the healthier behaviors that seem so natural when I am feeling accepted and good about who I am. When we start to explore the concept that all shame is bad and destructive, it really forces us to reevaluate how we use shame to parent, how we use shame to fight with partners, and on a community and societal level, how we use shame to punish. In a world that still falls back on, "You should be ashamed of yourself, shame on you, and have you no shame," the time has come to explore the possibility that we are safer in a world where people aren't mired in shame. To help you think about these concepts, I invite you to compare the following two approaches to working with men who batter their partners. As a social worker, domestic violence is a very important subject to me, and one that I spend a lot of my time and energy trying to understand. In Harriet Lerner's book, The Dance of Connection, she tells a story about Ron, a man who punches his wife Sharon in the face and stomach and is forced to attend court-ordered therapy sessions. Dr. Lerner explains that Ron resists being in a group of batterers, but is willing and even interested in joining a group of men who have trouble controlling their anger. Dr. Lerner writes, Ron was resisting the notion that his crime defined him. You might argue that Ron is a batterer, and that any language that softens or obscures this fact leaves him less accountable for his actions. But Ron will be more likely to accept responsibility and feel remorse if he can view himself as more than a batterer. For people to look squarely at their harmful actions and to become genuinely accountable, they must have a platform of self-worth to stand on. Only from the vantage point of higher ground can people who commit harm gain perspective. Only from there can they apologize. Dr. Lerner goes on to explain that refusing to take on an identity defined by one's worst deeds is a healthy act of resistance. If Ron's identity as a person is equated with his violent acts, he won't accept responsibility or access genuine feelings of sorrow and remorse, because to do so would threaten him with feelings of worthlessness. Dr. Lerner concludes the section in her book by writing, "We cannot survive when our identity is defined by, or limited to, our worst behavior. Every human must be able to view the self as complex and multidimensional. When this fact is obscured, people will wrap themselves in layers of denial in order to survive. How can we apologize for something we are, rather than something we did?" Now, let's contrast Harriet Lerner's thoughts on battering and the need for self-worth to the views of Judge Ted Poe. Judge Poe, who is now a member of the U.S. House of Representatives, has received local and national attention for his shame and humiliation punishment of criminals. In two separate cases, Judge Poe ordered men who assaulted their wives to make public apologies in front of the family law courthouse in downtown Houston. The apologies were delivered in front of hundreds of downtown employees during the lunch hour. In an editorial piece written by Poe and published in the Houston Chronicle, Poe defends his actions by writing, "Let those who would beat their wives, steal their neighbor's property, and abuse children feel the sting of the community's intolerance, hear their names on our lips, and pay the price in full view of the public. Shame on them, or shame on us." I leave you with these questions. If your husband was battering you, and he was forced to apologize on the steps of City Hall in front of hundreds of people, would you like to be the woman he comes home to after his day of public shaming? Given what we know about shame and how it affects us, are we safer with him when he's in shame or when he is repairing shame? Are we using shame as a punishment because we think it will foster real change in people? Or are we shaming others because it feels good to make people suffer when we are in fear, anger, or judgment? Developing shame resilience. Developing shame resilience, this ability to move toward empathy in the face of shame, is not an easy process. If it were, shame would not be such a prevalent and destructive force in our lives. One of the greatest challenges to developing shame resilience is the way shame actually makes us less open to giving or receiving empathy. Shame protects itself by making it very difficult for us to access its antidote. When we are in shame, reaching out for empathy feels very dangerous and risky. And when we are in shame and someone reaches out to us, it is very difficult to dig deep and find anything beyond fear, anger, and blame. As I read through the interviews I conducted with these courageous women, I tried to identify the qualities that helped women develop shame resilience. Did the women who were successful in overcoming shaming experiences have anything in common? Did the women who were able to give and receive empathy have different information or skills from the women who struggled more with their shame? The answer to both questions is yes. I found four elements that were shared by all the women who demonstrated high levels of shame resilience. They are: 1. The ability to recognize and understand their shame triggers. 2. High levels of critical awareness about their shame web. 3. the willingness to reach out to others. 4. The ability to speak shame. For the sake of an organized presentation on paper, the four elements are forced into linear order, 1 through 4. I'm presenting them in the order that reflects what I have heard most often in the interviews. It's important to understand, however, that this is different for everyone. Some women start with the fourth element of speaking out. Others start with the second or third element. You know yourself best. Please think about the information in this book in the context of your own life and experiences, and begin developing resilience or practicing empathy in the areas where you are most comfortable. Success there will likely give you confidence to begin working in the areas you consider more difficult. Additionally, in the chapters describing the four elements of shame resilience, I've included some written exercises. I've used these exercises with thousands of women. Most find them to be an extremely helpful start to the process. You are welcome to follow along and keep your own journal with the exercises, or you can just read them and think about them. If you go to my website, www.brenebrown.com, you can download the pre-formatted exercises. I've had many people tell me that they worked through the exercises with a friend, siblings, or with a group of friends. I've talked to many women who read them as part of their group therapy. I actually think working through the process with other people is one of the most effective ways to develop shame resilience. Shame happens between people, and it heals between people. It's just important that you have some level of trust and confidence in your relationship, so you feel safe exploring these ideas. I also think there is power in writing down our thoughts, reading them, and reflecting on them. All of the exercises were developed with writing in mind. Again, you are welcome to read them and think about them, or write them all down. Find a way that is meaningful for you. 3. The first element, recognizing shame and understanding our triggers. If we're going to build shame resilience, we have to start by recognizing and identifying shame. Because shame floods us with strong emotions like fear and blame, we often can't recognize what's happening until after we've already reacted in a way that moves us away from our authenticity and, in some cases, exacerbates our shame. For example, the mother whose credit card was declined. She was overwhelmed with feelings of shame and took it out on her crying child. Most of us with children are not strangers to that phenomenon. It happens in a split second. The goal is to learn to recognize when we are experiencing shame quickly enough to prevent ourselves from lashing out at those around us. Or if, as in this example, we have already yelled at our child, we want to learn to immediately stop, calm down, take a breath, and make amends. Somewhat paradoxically, our bodies often react to shame even before our conscious minds do. People always think it's strange when I ask them where and how they physically feel shame. But for most of us, shame has a feeling. It's physical as well as emotional. This is why I often refer to shame as a full contact emotion. Women have described various physical reactions to shame, including stomach tightening, nausea, shaking, waves of heat in their faces and chests, wincing and twinges of smallness. If we recognize our physical responses, sometimes we can limit the powerlessness that we feel when we are in shame. When I started this research project, I was unaware of my own physical responses to shame. I only started investigating them after interviewing the first 50 women. At that point in the research, it became clear to me that women with high levels of shame resilience recognized and could describe their physical reactions to shame. One woman told me, "My mouth gets really dry and I feel like I can't swallow. I try to recognize it and name it right away." When I asked her how, she said she starts whispering, "Pain, pain, 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 pain." She explained, once she can acknowledge what's happening, she can make better choices about how to deal with it. I thought it was a little strange until I tried it. I doubt it will work for everyone, but I think it's a great example of how recognizing a physical indication of shame increases our opportunity to be mindful and to react consciously. The questions below are designed to help us focus on recognizing our physical reaction to shame. Spend some time thinking about these or answering them on paper. Some may fit